If you're listening to this, you really want to know more about drugs and Santa. So we will get to the interviews in just a second. If you stumbled on this, this is the long uncut interviews that I did for a podcast, The Weird Christmas Podcast, episode number 7, I think it was, all about Santa and magic mushrooms. So go check out weirdchristmas.com and search for podcast or anything like that. Otherwise, what we're going to hear now is about half an hour, a little more, with Dr. John Rush, who is professor of anthropology at Sierra College. He gives a lot of really good information here. And then a very short interview, about 10, 15 minutes, with Dr. Carl Ruck, who is professor of classics, at Boston University. I'll put some links to both of their works and their main sites up on the post on weirdchristmas.com about the podcast. If you are interested in following up on this, there are a lot of books that have been written in and around this topic, and I think they're pretty interesting, even if sometimes they get a little out there. So anyway, hope you guys enjoy it.
Actually, I'm a physical anthropologist, and the business with the different herbs and all, but that's sort of a secondary issue for me.
Gotcha.
I've spent a lot of time studying this, certainly, since the late 60s and so on. But there's a lot of information out here, and some of the questions that you asked are quite interesting in the email. A very complex subject. But at any rate, you go ahead with your questions, and let's see what we can do with this.
Well, great. Sounds good. Well, let's just start with the general idea. I know there are a lot of theories out there connecting Santa to the mushroom. Also, it's the more common name for it. I've forgotten what it is already. No, the
fly agate is one, that's used with it. But for the most part, Animita muscaria is the one that's being used most frequently now.
Gotcha. So if you wouldn't mind, just how do you describe the connection, or what do you think the general notion of the connection is?
Okay, the connection goes back a long, long, long season. We have to go back into ancient Egypt, actually, for the connection to Christianity, although the mushrooms themselves probably been used for, way back in the Paleolithic. It's hard to know. We know shamanism. We have images of shamans in caves in France dating to about 20,000 BC. So, they're using these substances, and I'm certainly not the only one that's saying this. We don't know exactly what they were using, but some of the effects that are presented in the art suggest things anyway. But anyway, let's go to ancient Egypt. Ancient Egypt, we start off with Akhenaten. This would be Moses in the Bible. Akhenaten was a heretic pharaoh, and when he was crowned king, for a while anyway, things were pretty smooth. And then he closed down all the Amun-Ra palaces. He closed down the priesthood and so on, and told everyone the only thing they could worship was the Aten sun disk. Now, the Aten sun disk is an image of the Animita muscaria mushroom, and that's how it gets into Judaism through Akhenaten. It's a long story. Have you seen my book, Failed God?
I have. I have not read it, but I have seen it and know what it's about, yes.
Yeah. If you read the chapter on Judaism there, you can see the connection between Moses and Akhenaten and so on and so forth. There's only a couple of people in the Bible that we can pin down as real people. Joseph is one, and he's Yuya in ancient Egypt, and Moses would be Akhenaten. There's no historical visibility for anybody else. There's no historical visibility for Jesus. There's no historical visibility for Muhammad or any of these individuals, and so they represent something else. The problem with Christianity is that it presents itself as a historical religion. In other words, it's pure history. And, of course, they have to have a storyline that goes along with it. And, of course, they borrowed from just about every tradition on the planet. That's why it's so hard to figure out this business at Christmas, because it's bits of pieces from Greek and Roman and ancient Egypt and certainly the Celtic and so on and so forth. And so it's hard to kind of put the whole thing together. But there are some basic themes with it. So we can see the use of the mushroom going way back to ancient Egypt. They got the mushrooms from probably Lebanon. They grow synergistically on the Lebanese cedars. There are not too many Lebanese cedars in Lebanon anymore, but that's where they would have gotten them. And Osiris gets connected to the mushroom. when he's killed by his evil brother, and in a casket and thrown into the Nile, it floats over, eventually goes to Lebanon, and a Lebanese cedar tree, the roots grow around the casket, you see, and so that's he's a reference to the mushroom as well. So it goes back a long, long season. Now, in Christianity, certainly, in order for the Christian tradition to work, they need bodies, they need people. And so how are you going to get people to join? Well, you get them to join by tapping into their myths and stories and so on, and you sort of combine them with your own. And that's why it's so complicated to figure out, you know, the bits and pieces that came into Christianity, because it came into from many, many sources. So as sort of a general background, we can see ancient Egypt, we can see Greek and Roman, certainly the Jewish tradition, adding into this and so on, and coming out of the Celtic tradition as well, and the Indo-European people. So again, it's pretty complicated.
I was going to say, and that's interesting, because that's a wider background than I think a lot of the most of the explanations between the connection that I've seen. Most of them, it seems, trace that primarily to Siberia rather than the larger cultural tradition that you're talking about.
Right. The mushroom itself is cosmopolitan. It grows all over the place. It grows in North America and so on. We can go to Mormonism, for example. In the Mormon tradition, if we start off with Joseph Smith Jr., he was introduced to all these substances by his father, Joseph Smith Sr., and he settled on mescaline or peyote as his substance of choice that he used to magically to find lost objects. He had a magic hat and all that. This is why he was assassinated, because he was ripping people off, and so the Masons got rid of him, essentially. And then Brigham Young sort of canceled it all, because he realized there could only be one celestial truth. And if you had all these people taking these substances, you'd have many celestial truths. And so he sort of toned the whole thing down. But it all came back into existence again with Frederick Smith in about 1910 or whatever. He wrote an interesting book about it. I've got a YouTube site on it talking about Mormonism. The golden plates have been found. You can go in there and look at that. The golden plates are actually the caps of Anamita Muscaria. And back during the time of Joseph Smith Jr., everything was Egyptian. There was people were fanatic about it, and the mummies and all that. And so if you let an Anamita Muscaria mushroom cap dry, when it cracks, you can see what appear to be hieroglyphs. And so that's where we get all that business out. But it's all drug related.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. The Mormon connection, too. That's very interesting. I'll have to look that up, too. And I'll, by the way, I will put some links to some of those sites on the... I have a website version of this, too. So we'll get the links to the YouTube up there as well. Well,
yeah, I've got YouTubes on Judaism, Christianity, Islam. The site is Osiris 12 Gates.
Gotcha.
I believe that's the site. And you can go in there and see some of those. They've been up for a while.
Gotcha.
At any rate, that gives you sort of a general idea of the problem of piecing all this together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's even more interesting, I have to say, than just some of the connections that I've read about so far. So, but let's talk about then Santa himself. What is the connection that it seems to be there between the Santa myth, the colors, the reindeer, all of those different aspects of the legend that seem to connect to the mushroom?
Well, what we're dealing here certainly is with shamanism, and we can see the aspect of shamanism and the wearing of those clothes. We can take that right back to about 15,000 BC in a cave in France called the Cave of the Three Brothers. And in that we see a shaman, and there's very few images of people in these caves anywhere that anybody's ever found. There's a couple of them that I'm aware of, and this is one of them. And what it is a human being who becomes the animal master. The original animal master was probably a bear, but the cave bear dies out, and so they're in trouble with that, and so they, through their own creativity, they come up with the human being the animal master. And you see him in the cave, and he's dressed in a composite animal suit with the antlers and a red deer skin. a suit and so on. He's got a wolf's tail and feline genitals and so on and so forth. We also see a similar image, almost exactly the same. It was drawn in 1780 by an artist of a shaman in the Northwest Territories of Canada, wearing the same kind of suit with the antlers and so on. This is Shunanus. This is Woden. This is the Green Man in the Celtic tradition. And so we can see where this shamanic idea has come down through, and the clothing has stayed pretty much the same. Now, it was sort of standardized or became an icon, oh, probably beginning in the 15th or 16th century with Father Winter, who's all bundled up with a sack on his back, and he's bringing toys to children. We see that in Europe. The more recent renderings of this, probably the best are Thomas Nast with his image of Santa, and it's definitely a shaman. And the reason we know this is because of the holly he's wearing on his head. It's Ilex aquifolium, and the magicalness of that is if you throw it at an animal, it'll lay down and do what you tell it to do. And so it shows a shaman, Santa as the animal master, the shaman. But he's got two characteristics. He's got good characteristics, he's got evil characteristics. This is why he hangs out sometimes with Ruprecht, who's probably symbolic of Thor or some of those other deities back then. So he's got a negative side to him as well. So he punishes evil children with a stick that he hits them with. It's made out of a special kind of wood. I'm kind of forgetting what it's called. Hazelwood. So he carries that. So Santa's not only a good guy, he's kind of an evil guy too, which represents the dark side and the light side of life, you know, the good and evil that's out there. The story is that we have shaman who, during the solstice, and this is the connection of Jesus and the new sun and so on and so forth, going around in the fall and collecting these Animita muscaria mushrooms and then distributing them on the solstice. And of course, this business of the chimney. The chimney is an interesting symbol here. We can get to that later. But at any rate, during the winter months, you can't get into the house. And so they all had trap doors in the roofs, you know, because there was just so much snow around. And so that's kind of Santa coming into the house. The pine tree is brought into the house so that you could get the gift under the tree. And what's the gift under the tree? Well, it's the Animita muscaria mushroom, because it grows synergistically off of the roots of pine trees and cedar trees and so on and so forth. So that's a little bit of backdrop with him. Now, when you look at Nast's drawing, you also see the red coat, you see the buckles, and so on and so forth. And these buckles and brass things on them are probably symbolic also of the harnesses that hook onto the reindeer and so on. The original reindeer that Odin drove around with were Cracker and Nasher, and they were goats, actually. They weren't reindeer. And that's where we get the flying reindeer business, and that's connected to the mushroom as well. People have actually seen the reindeer going out and digging for these mushrooms and actually seeking out urine from other reindeers that have consumed the mushroom, because what you get out of the urine is the muscimol. It's the pure muscimol, and you don't have the bad effects of it. Keep in mind also that the mushroom takes you through the three stages, life, death, and return. If you've ever consumed the cap of the mushroom, you'll know what it does to you. It makes you sick, and you think you've killed yourself. And then you're with God or whatever, and then you come back. And so there's a whole bunch of bits and pieces here that get connected back into Christianity. The waters of everlasting life, for example, that's urine drinking. And with the urine drinking, you go right to God's place without the death business that goes along with it. At any rate, that gives you a little bit of idea about Santa.
That's pretty interesting. I have to say, too, when you mention the Green Man and the old Woden, there's a book about that argues, actually, that you may be familiar with it, but Phyllis Siefker who wrote it, Santa Claus Last of the Wild Men, and she doesn't talk about the mushroom, I believe, in there, but she does have a whole lot of connections to early European iconography with the wild man and the green man and how that comes into the Santa.
Yeah, they're all interconnected. So when you see the image of Santa, I mean, you've got to go in a hundred different directions at the same time in order to try and understand it. But I think one of the major things here is that it's a connection to the other side. It's a connection to the magic, the spirituality of the whole thing, and that is brought about by these substances, and there's lots of them. Christmas not only is connected to the mushroom, but it's connected to hellebore and datura and belladonna and all of these kinds of substances that were used at different times during the year.
That's interesting. What could you say a little bit more about those and where we might see that in, you know?
Well, we have things like the witch's ointment, the flying ointments, if you will, and these are made out of fat with belladonna. They take the belladonna berries and they grind them up with the fat, and then they rub it into the skin. It's absorbable through the skin or into a mucous membrane. You can guess which one they're using here. And what you're dealing with is scopolamine, which is a very potent hallucinogen, and if you take sufficient amounts of it, you get the sensation that you're flying. And so these are the flying ointments. You also get the sensation that you're changing shape. And you got to be careful with these substances because they can drive you crazy. You've heard of loco weed? Mm-hmm. Well, that's datura. We hear it mostly in the United States, but it's still scopolamine, and it'll drive you crazy. And so those were the flying ointments, the witches' ointments, and so on. They used to brew beers with henbane, Pilsenkraut, it was called. And that was outlawed by the Catholic Church because people stopped going to church. They were consuming this on Sunday instead. You can drink about a quart of the stuff. It's made out of grains and henbane, not hops. Hops isn't very much fun. Hops, like alcohol, is a depressant. But when you put the henbane in there, you're getting the scopolamine. You can drink about a quart of the stuff, and then you can't function. And so there's so many of these different substances around that were being used. And, of course, cannabis. Cannabis comes in with the Indo-Europeans, and it certainly didn't displace alcohol, but was used alongside of it. And cannabis actually is mentioned in the Bible. They say calamus root. If you go to Exodus 30, 1 through 30, they give you the formula for the anointing oils, which is another interesting thing. One of the ingredients that they mention in the Bible is calamus root, but we know it's a mistranslation of cannabosin, which is cannabis. And so they lace their oils with cannabis. Used probably to connect with God, but in the Christian tradition, cannabis was used more as a healing agent. I have a wonderful mosaic that comes from a cathedral in Sicily of Jesus standing there. He's healing sick people, and to his off of his left shoulder is a great big picture of a cannabis leaf, and then to the left of that, to the right of that in the image is a mountain that's made up of mushrooms. And so the Christian art is just loaded with these images, and the problem I have is that how come no one's ever seen these except John Allegro back in 1970? You know who Allegro was?
From things that you have said that I've read.
Yeah, well, John Allegro wrote a book called the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And back in the 1950s, he was, because of his ability to speak and understand ancient Hebrew and Coptic and all these other languages, he was given a portion of the Dead Sea Scrolls to translate. And of course, he wasn't Jewish, he's not Christian, he's not Islamic or anything like that. And so he translated them, and he was one of the first to publish his translations. Unfortunately, they gave him the section of the Dead Sea Scrolls that talked about Isu, which is the Arabic word for Jesus, who is connected to the Teacher of Righteousness, which he found linguistically connected to the Animita muscaria mushroom. And so in 1970, he published his book, The Sacred Mushroom of the Cross, and the Catholic Church crucified this poor guy. He wasn't able to finish his doctorate in Europe, anywhere. He ended up teaching at a little community college somewhere, if you will. And when the church goes out of its way to do something like that, you know that Allegra found out something that they didn't want him to find out, and that is the use of this mushroom.
Very cool. Very interesting. So
now the anointing oils, if you want to talk about that a little bit, that comes into Christianity from ancient Egypt as well. In the hieroglyphs, and I've been working with the I also teach archaeology, so I'm very interested in the books of the dead and so on and so forth, and translating these. We have a word called mishi, which is actually crocodile fat that was laced with something, and the something is probably Egyptian henbane, which is probably 100 times more potent than the henbane that's grown in Europe. And they laced this oil with it, and then when the pharaoh was crowned king, they would pour this over his head and bring him close to death, which brought him close to the gods. And he had to do this. Now, mishi comes into the Hebrew tradition as Messiah. And then it comes into the Christian tradition as Christos, the anointed one. And so these oils stayed in there as well. They're probably used in different ways, and maybe different constituents in them. I think probably cannabis was the one used by the Hebrew and in the Christian, and I think henbane was used by the ancient Egyptians. So we have these anointing oils. They're called oils of gladness, by the way, in the Christian tradition. And they were used quite frequently until fairly recent times. I think what happened was they realized that the oils themselves didn't connect you to God. They had a chemical that changed your brain chemistry. And this would be fairly recent thinking on this. But the problem here is, as well, if you change a symbol, it loses its power. So these substances are still being used, but they don't want to talk about it. I'm sure in the Catholic Church, the Animi Mascari is used as well. But they don't want to talk about it. Now, I did have an Anglican bishop confess to me. He was also an art historian at, Notre Dame. He was an art historian there. And he finally admitted that there were esoteric groups in the Christian community that did still use these substances. But he wouldn't elaborate on that at all. And, you know, they're secret, so it's hard to find out about them.
Interesting. Well, as far as the images that we have, I know that the mushrooms, they actually still appear, I know, in a lot of common greeting cards, especially in Norwegian countries. And that's where I still see, you know, if I look back at sort of the history of greeting cards and images and things like that, the mushrooms show up still a lot around Christmas and New Year's. And it's particularly Northern Europe where you see that. I do have some images in Victorian times of the mushrooms coming in. But do you have any notion why they might still be very popular images in the northern countries?
Well, yeah, I think that some of the meaning has been lost to it, but I think that they reference luck. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In other words, the lucky mushroom and the lucky broom used to sweep out chimneys, and chimneys representing in some way, because it's an open fire in a house, the house is a pipe. And you're smoking it, really. And anyways, you need to keep that chimney clean so that the smoke could go up to the gods, or the messages could go up to the gods and so on. And so you're talking around this whole business of luck. And if you have a mushroom like that, or a chimney sweep's broom, or even the image of a chimney sweep, these are kind of lucky images throughout Europe. And keep in mind that that whole area, the geography, would be certainly closer to all of this. And also, Europe has been best studied of any cultural group in the world. The Europeans have been better studied than anybody else. And so that's one of the reasons that we have all this information. We don't have the same kind of information out of the Middle East. They trashed a lot of their own history in order to create Islam. But you don't get the bits and pieces because the research hasn't been done.
That's fascinating. Well, are there any other particularly Christmas or other holiday traditions that you might be aware of that are particularly for America or you know, Western Europe, that are connected to the hallucinogens or any other entheogens?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of them. For example, May Day, Beltane in the Celtic tradition. This is the first of the year. This is the planting season. And it's also connected to Esther, or Easter, who is the Saxon goddess of fertility. And so what these people would do on May 1st is they go out and they plow their fields, and they build these little huts and make them as airtight as possible, and they gather up cannabis buds, get the buds going, and they climb in these little huts and get pretty stoned, and then go out and copulate in the fields to promote fertility. And I don't think there's any holiday in Europe that isn't connected in some way to alcohol or cannabis or some of these other substances. Excuse me, I've got a cough, so hold on for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Bad case of allergies out here. At any rate, so we can see many, many holidays that are connected to substances, mind-altering substances, for sure.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, just, and this is sort of my question for me, not necessarily for the podcast, but just I'm curious. With these connections, do you, and I have to apologize because I haven't read a lot of your work in detail, although now I'm going to, so I can definitely. I'm curious, as you're, do you have a sense of if you're arguing in a way that the hallucinogens are responsible for a lot of the spiritual ideas, or is it just iconography and experiences that go along with the various theologies and things like that?
Well, I wrote the introductory chapter to my latest book, Entheogens and the Development of Culture. I talk about decision making, and we go from shamans who are working for the benefit of the group or the individual who's sick, and of course we're dealing with small groups of people, to these nation states where you have kings with soothsayers or magicians or whatever, and they have to make decisions. And many times they don't have sufficient information to do so. So what do they do? Do they wait around for one of these oracles to get sick or to have a fever or have a near-death experience before they can go to the other side? No. They're going to use something tried and true, and that would be these substances, which we've been in contact with for probably a couple of million years. There's a very interesting article by Wesselman in that Entheogens book that talks about our liver and how the chemicals in it what we can metabolize indicates that we've been in connection with many of these substances for a long, long, long time. And so you can have mystical experiences when you're sick, or near-death experiences and so on, but the quickest way to get there is with these substances.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
So that's why I think they're so pervasive here, and we see the iconography. I think a lot of the meaning has been lost, and you're just, for some people, just looking at pretty plants.
Sure.
But the deeper meaning is that these have been used to commune with the other side, to either solve problems or for a spiritual adventure or from sort of indoctrination and so on and so forth. You have to understand, the early Christians, the small groups of the Christ groups or Jesus groups or Manichaeans or whoever they were, we don't really know, these early groups, the parables that are referenced by our mythic hero Jesus were designed to see if a person was smart enough to go to the other side and learn something spiritual. And so they would, give you a parable, and if you could answer it, then you could commune with God. And these were small groups of people. These, this idea of Jesus talking to the multitudes of 5,000 people, the Romans would never have allowed 5,000 people to gather anywhere. If more than two people gathered on a street corner, the Gestapo was right there to stop them. And so the storyline around Jesus is an interesting one, for sure, but it's all made up. There is no historical visibility whatsoever for him, and what we do have, we know are forgeries. And we know at least who forged one of them into Josephus's Jewish Wars, and that would be Eusebius of Caesarea. And Josephus was a Jew. He would have had no interest in someone like Jesus, who was contrary and telling the secrets of the system. Now, the individual who might have been real might have been John the Baptist. He's the wild man again, who comes out of the desert and introduces Jesus to the world, and that's the enemy of Muscaria Mushroom. Now, if you get a hold of my book, The Mushroom and Christian Art, there's a DVD there, and as you go through all those images, you'll run into one, or actually there's a couple of them in there, that show the fly connected to Jesus. Either the fly is on his leg or it's on a ledge next to them and Mother Mary is pointing at it and so on and so forth. Why a fly? Well, flies crawl up into the gills of the mushroom and they lay their eggs and they rot the mushroom. They destroy it. And so the fly is the enemy to the mushroom. And so that's what you're seeing in the image. Jesus was the enemy to Muscaria mushroom.
That also explains why you always hear about flies with hell and Satan and
yeah,
images like that.
Beelzebub and all that. Yeah, that all comes in there as, into that as well. The one thing that needs to be explained by the church is why the mushroom is so pervasive in the art. And they won't. They won't explain this.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, then, if Santa and a lot of the images of Santa, that's another way that it seems like the images, if there is a strong connection there between the mushroom and Santa, even more direct, if nothing else with the colors, then,
yeah.
I mean, it's coming back. Maybe that explains a little bit more, sort of how...
Well, there's another way to look at it, too, and that is the Pope wears a mushroom garb. And you can see this in the DVD that goes with the book. The red cape, if you will, the crown that's got bumps all over it and so on and so forth, you have to see. Not only that, when the cardinals get together in Rome and they're milling about, they often have a camera that's up on the ceiling, and you look down on their heads with these little white and red caps on their heads, they look like the mushroom. this just can't be coincidence, if you will. Now, Hildegard of Bingen, who was recently sainted, was very much an aficionado of the mushroom, and it comes out in all her art. She was a nun back in the 13th century. And she was recently sainted. She was also a lesbian, which is okay, too. But she brought these substances right out in her art, and no one ever said anything about it. It was a pretty lax time during that time period, and people could get away with a little bit more. And this is what you see in the art. When they're a little bit more lax, the mushroom is a little more obvious. When they've kind of come down on that and they don't want people to see it, you see more motifs of the mushroom, like mushroom shoes, or mushroom wings on the angels and this type of thing to try and disguise it. But in many cases, there's no way you can disguise this. It's what it is. It's the enemy Muscaria mushroom. And it has to be there for a reason. All this art is commissioned, and the artist is told what to put into it. He has to have, he has to have his imagination stimulated prior to starting the art. He's got to be stimulated in some way, and that's probably use of some sort of substance, although no one seems to want to admit any of this. But at any rate, this art was commissioned, and you can't have whimsy. The person would be hung up by you-know-what if they were trying to put stuff into the art that the church didn't want. So it's all commissioned. They're told what to put in it. I assume that in some of these cathedrals where we find a lot of this art, there are books that tell what to put where and so on and so forth. I've never seen one of these, but I hear they exist.
Very fascinating, very fascinating. Well, one last thing I was just curious. Do you happen to have any favorite images of Santa or of the mushroom or anything sort of holiday related?
Well, in the Mushroom and Christian Art book, there are a number of these images there. Let me point you in the direction of a very interesting book that it's readily available out there. It's called Pagan Christmas.
Yes.
Maybe you've seen it.
Yes. Yes.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have. I have it. Yep.
Okay. Well, then that's got a lot of the stuff in it that shows, you know, Santa and Coca-Cola and everything mm-hmm. connected to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting book. Now, again, as you read through that, you can see how complicated the thing is trying to figure this all out. Another individual that you might want to look at his writings is Karl Ruck. He spent a lot of time looking at the Greek and Roman myths and pointing out the connection to the mushrooms and so on and so forth. Like in King Arthur, there's another example. King Arthur, Avalon. He's supposed to be buried at Avalon. You know what Avalon means? It means golden apple, and the reference there is the enemy to Muscaria mushroom. It pops up all over the place.
That's great. Yeah, to be honest, I actually did reach out to Dr. Ruck as well, and I haven't heard back yet, but if I hear from him too, then I was hoping to do sort of put both you guys together here. If you're okay with
it. He has a couple of articles that are in that last book that I edited there,
okay.
Entheogens in the Development Culture. He's got a couple of interesting articles there you might want to see.
Great.
Maybe you've got the book, I don't know.
It's on its way, actually, so this is...
Okay.
This is, yeah, no, like I said...
Yeah, and now, the story of Hildegard, it took up about 100 pages of the book. But I wanted the whole story about her and so on. So I think you'll find that quite interesting as well. But there's a lot of interesting stuff. And they look at the mushroom and its use all over the world, from Mexico all the way over to India and so on and so forth. So you'll see a lot of good information in there for you. And all those images are up on my website, and it shows you how to get there and so on.
Great. All right. Well, look, I don't want to keep you too much longer. We've gone over a half an hour, but this has been fascinating.
The reality of the situation is that he wears a bear skin. He wears it inside out with the fur towards his body. But he is a version of the Nordic berserkers who either materialized or wore bear skins or wolf skins in battle, and they go way back. Most people know the mummy from the 11th century, when the Nordic epics were not committed to writing, but these berserkers showed up at the time of Trajan, and probably they go even further back in classical antiquity.
Interesting. Well, so I'm going to record this, our talking, if you don't mind, and then add it in and edit it all up a little bit later. But would you mind, first of all, sort of laying out what the general outlines of the connection are between Santa and the mushroom?
And people apparently have known this for some time, but Saint Nick, I guess, is part of our tradition only in the 19th century with the night before Christmas, but that is derived probably from folk motifs of the Dutch immigrants. So it goes back to the Old World. And it's interesting that when he first appeared, he didn't have a red coat, but he had a green coat, which is even more significant because it associates him with not as the personification of the red Amis Muscaria, but as the spirit of the wilderness, the green man, and so on. But people apparently have known this because, it's in the 1940s, they added Ludolf, and it's quite humorous or ironic that he has a bright red nose, which is certainly suggestive of the mushrooms. But Brown and his wife in the psychedelic gospels, they go further than this and talk about how in Siberia, living in their tents, when the snows pile, the way you enter the tent is through the smoke hole.
And I know that still in especially Nordic countries, the mushroom is actually part of often holiday decorations and holiday iconography. Is that right?
Absolutely. Now, it's not only the reindeer that like mushrooms, apparently, but that is documented. As you probably know, that the toxins in Amanita muscaria pass on into the urine. And when they are high, when people are high with Amanita muscaria in Siberia, they have to be careful when they go out to pee because they'll be stampeded by the reindeer who want to come and drink the pee. they really love Amanita muscaria, but it's documented there in the ethnographic record, but all deer probably, many animals like eating psychoactive substances, and so it's probable that tales of lycanthropy turning into wolves, which is what the other thing the berserkers turned into. They didn't turn into bears, they turned into wolves. The wolf dogs like eating mushrooms, and so it probably lies behind that tradition as well. And it leads to the metaphor for the altered state of consciousness as being rabidity. Foaming at the mouth is of that kind. But as far as occurrences of this in Europe, you can document it probably in classical mythology, but in the Middle Ages, there were two saints that, while they were out hunting, saw a vision of the crucified Christ between the antlers of a deer. And this probably indicates that the metaphor of the deer hunt refers to looking for the mushroom that embodies their shamanic spirit. So the deer hunt, which is a popular theme in medieval and Renaissance literature, it probably derives from hunting for the mushroom and for the vision quest.
Oh, now that's interesting. That's not a connection I'd heard before, so that's pretty interesting.
Two saints, folkloric saints. Saint Eustace, you can look them up on Wikipedia. Saint Eustace and Saint Hubertus. They both saw Christ crucified when they were out hunting, crucified between the antlers of a deer.
Interesting. Well, how do you think? I think I've read one or two places before where you talked about it. May have been that Clement Clark Moore, when he wrote, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, that he might have been aware of some of these iconographies, or that's one of the places where we might see that? Or how else do you think it might have gotten into sort of modern day images?
Immigrants from Europe brought with them their folk motifs, and you can look this up on Google also, but John Rackham, who is an illustrator, Victorian illustrator, and he illustrated the tale of Rip Van Winkle, who falls asleep for a long period and comes back again, which is a rather transparent metaphor for going into the shamanic trance and coming back again. But he illustrated it with Omnica Muscaria. And there's no reason for him to add it unless he knew the Dutch motif.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Very interesting. Well, one other thing I know that has come up with that is that apparently the mushrooms often grow underneath pine trees.
Yeah.
And that's sort of similar to, of course, presence being under a tree. Is that true?
That's true, yes.
Interesting. So that could have been another way that the
connection. Yeah, Brown goes into the gifts and so forth in his book.
Interesting. So what did the actual shamans, I'm curious, when they would do this, was this for a, or when they would use the mushrooms, was it for a sort of shamanistic healing practice, or when it was actually performed or used, do you know what the purpose was of actually taking the mushrooms?
Yeah, I don't know whether it was healing or whether it was making contact with spirits or aiding in the hunt. I don't know what their meaning given to it was.
Gotcha. But it is interesting that the reindeer fly, and go on a trip, as it were. Interesting. Well, now I know I actually spoke with John Rush as well, who you may be familiar with, and I know that he's done work on this. And he and I talked a little bit about not just this connection, but how mushrooms or other hallucinogens were used in other holiday celebrations. And I know your work has to do a lot with particularly ancient cultures. But are you aware of any other connections with mushrooms or any sort of drug? I think the term is entheogen, used in other holiday traditions, or that might be the origin of other holiday traditions?
It may be involved also with Easter and the Easter eggs.
Oh, interesting. So could that be this mushroom, or there be something?
It's strange, but there are other mushrooms that are psilocybin, and some of them produce a better experience than more pleasant experience than psilocybin mushrooms. But the one that figures in the folklore motif is always red with white spots.
That's great. Interesting indeed.
Otherwise, they wouldn't ornament the illustration with the
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. Well, that's great. That gives me quite a lot to go on. And I appreciate the suggestion for the book too. And I'll definitely hunt that down. Is there, by the way, since when I do this, I'm going to sort of cut and paste some of the different pieces together, but is there anything of yours that you would like me to mention? You know, I can give a little shout out to a new book or any current research or something like that.
Well, we published a book, Mushrooms, Myths, and Nitrous, The Drug Cult That Civilized Europe. And it's about Zoroastrian religion as it was proselytized in Europe. It became one of the dominant religions of the Roman Empire. Most of the emperors and the male bureaucrats and most of the soldiers were initiated. There are initiation chambers all over Europe. There are small underground places where they're supposed to have a steak dinner. But once you see one, you have to confine it. It was meant to be a place where you entered into a trance state and then experienced spiritual liberation to the cosmos. This is what their mythology, theology, explains it. And this is the way of the Stoma cult, which in the Persian tradition was Halma, and Zoroastrian, Iranian, ancient Iranian Persian religion. It's the way it spread through Europe, and so it was well established throughout Europe, and we argued that as part of this initiation that there was a mushroom festival. There were other drugs involved, but ultimately it was a mushroom festival.